Hi there, and welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast with me, Caroline Scott. In this week's episode, we'll be hearing about the production of Vox's upcoming international video series called Borders, six films about human stories that emerge from lines on the map. Whether it's the division of countries, states, or even between a city or neighbourhood, borders represent more than just different areas. In fact, they have an enormous impact on the lives of people living either side of them.
We humans have taken this earth that has no lines physically. It maybe has rivers or oceans or bodies of water, but it doesn't have any of these lines. And we've drawn these lines. We've decided, okay, these people live over here and you're going to obey a certain norm. And if you live on this side of this imaginary line, you obey this norm.
That's Johnny Harris, a video reporter at Vox, who's been spending the past few months travelling to different borders around the world, investigating the human effect that these lines on the map have.
It's all psychological, but it has real outcomes, real stories emerge from these lines. And that, to me, became kind of the centerpiece, almost an obsession of how not only just countries, but how we humans draw lines everywhere, within cities, within neighborhoods, within school districts, the way that we just slice things up in order to make sense of a kind of a chaotic world, and some of the stories that emerge from that. And so that was kind of the underpinning of this whole thing, was lines and conceptual lines and how they're drawn and what stories emerge. And I found that it's a very flexible concept. There's so many different manifestations of this idea of borders, and I've kind of been probing at that concept in a lot of different ways.
Back in May of this year, Vox appealed to its audience for suggestions as to where Johnny should go. Staff at the publisher hoped for at least 500 story ideas, but got 6,000 replies by people of all ages, creeds, and identities.
A lot of those were the ones you'd expect. India, Pakistan, Israel, Palestine, Cyprus, you know, the kind of hot button international superstar borders that people think about all the time and are kind of high profile. But then there was a huge amount of these obscure borders that I had never even heard about. And I tried to stress in the launch video, this isn't just international borders between two countries, although that is kind of the focus. I want this to be borders of all kinds. And so I got a lot of interesting city borders, a lot of relics from the segregation age in like Detroit and Chicago, when zoning and real estate were developed in a way that were very racially informed, to where today even you have neighborhoods that are still cut along those lines that were developed originally by racist real estate policies and zoning policies, and they still hold weight and they still have grown out of those policies. And there's sometimes in Detroit, you know, there's physical walls in certain places that divide neighborhoods along racial lines. So there was some interesting things like that. One of the most interesting borders that that I got that was a non-international border, and this didn't make it to the final cut, but if and when there's a season two, this certainly is like top of my list, is in Indonesia. There's this fascinating situation between this very pure, puritanical, almost religious group that has a inner sanctum of three villages that preserve their culture. And then outside of those three villages, there's a physical circle of 27 villages that are less puritanical, less dogmatic, less culturally pure, but they are basically, they serve as a border to protect that inner sanctum of those three cities, to preserve their culture. And so those three villages don't interact with the outside world, but these 27 villages do, as like a way of keeping the people at bay. They still practice the religion, but they kind of are emissaries for the religion, for the government, and they kind of interact in this really interesting way. Anyway, so there was a lot of stuff like that, stuff that I would have never been able to dig up with my Google skills. You know, I would have been able to dig around and type interesting borders here and there, and there's only so far I can do with just searching on the internet. when you call out to people who live around the world and you have the internet as just this huge network, suddenly you get ideas that you would have never, ever found otherwise, that have never been covered. And I got tons and tons of those to the point where it was almost painful. It was painful for me to say, I'm going to have to say no to 6,000 of these and only yes to six of them.
The chosen locations were borders at Japan, Svalbard, the Dominican Republic and Haiti, the US and Mexico, between Spain and Morocco, and then his next and final stop, which will be the border between China and Nepal. While he's been travelling, Johnny's been publishing video dispatches on Facebook, Instagram and the Vox YouTube channel, a separate venture to the six documentaries he's making along the way, which will be published in the fall. He wanted to keep involving the audience in the reporting as he travelled, aiming to build a community of people interested in the world, in maps and in culture. In fact, over the past few months, the audience have been part of the reporting, using social media to follow where Johnny was going, make suggestions and ask questions. It's been a way for Johnny to ensure he's serving the audience during his travels, providing them with the information that they want to know. But it's also been a great way for him as a journalist to find story ideas that he might not necessarily have been able to spot by himself.
This isn't just a cool novel idea. This is actually a kind of a strategy that we're developing for engagement and for reporting on both ends that is helping us on both those fronts. And we've been pursuing it in multiple different levels. And Borders is just now another expression of Vox's larger strategy of engaging the audience to bolster our reporting.
But don't be fooled. Keeping up with thousands of comments and suggestions while you're traveling and producing all this content relatively by yourself can be challenging.
Yeah, it gets really out of control with just a lot of suggestions and a lot of recommendations and a lot of questions, to the point where I often feel strained to like, man, I can't address all of this. This is just too much, which is like too much of a good thing almost. You know, it's like, this is what I wanted. And now that there's so many people following along, it's a little overwhelming. But that being said, there have been moments where in real time, I will get a suggestion that leads to a really interesting outcome. For example, when I was in Haiti traveling up the border, we got a suggestion that was, hey, if you keep going up this border road, you will stumble upon this village that is doing really cool things with these solar ovens. And these solar ovens that basically are mirrors that reflect the sun to heat up a pot or a pan so that people can cook without electricity and without having to burn wood, which is a huge problem in Haiti. Deforestation is a huge problem. And so I literally went to that village. Like I reached out to, the person gave me a contact of someone who's there and the organization that's helping with these solar ovens. And I went to the village, hung out with them, made a dispatch, just in an afternoon hanging out with them and published it.
You walk around this community and you notice these weird looking satellite dish things. This thing that looks like a satellite is actually an ingenious method to cook food using the sun. And I'm not talking about solar energy, which converts the sun into electricity and stores it in a battery. This is much more direct, much more ingenious.
And it was totally driven by the fact that someone reached out and told me about that. And that's happened quite a few times, not only with dispatches, although that also happened in Haiti with the Surfer Dispatch, this surfing organization down the coast that I went and visited. That was a really successful, I would say, outcome, where I was able to find a story that was totally off the map and do it. It wasn't a big, heavy lift story. It was just a little visit, a little dispatch. But it was something that I was able to do only because of the crowdsourcing dynamic of the project.
This is the only dispatch I'll ever do without a shirt on, so don't get used to it. Right now, if you go to big international competitions, you're not going to see any Haitian competitors. And these guys want to change that. They want to make surfing a legitimate sport in Haiti.
Surf kind of competition mondial, the Olympic, tout ça.
2020 Tokyo Olympics.
There's been that kind of on the story front. And then there's been little, hey, you should go to this taqueria in Mexico City, or make sure to try the coffee in Chiapas. My grandmother has a plantation out there and it's the best coffee in the world, blah, blah, blah. Like, that kind of stuff is that sort of local knowledge. To me, what it does is it synthesizes that same mentality of local, when you show up to a new place and you're traveling and you go to the local pub and you talk to the bartender and you discover all these local secrets of the place where you should go, the food you should eat. That's really valuable information. And that's information that, as someone who isn't a correspondent who embeds in one area for years, I rely on that. I rely on being able to leverage that local information in order to not only make my travels more interesting and more culturally immersive, but also my stories more powerful and more interesting. And so to me, it's been the fact that we have this mechanism of the internet to do this real time. You know, I'll be on my phone driving through some mountain range, and I'll have my phone and be looking at Facebook and seeing what people are saying while it's happening. And that sort of real-time interaction, to me, is a pinnacle of the use of these mediums of communication. It's really an awesome outcome, especially as a reporter, to see that happening.
Johnny's kit bag consists of a Sony Alpha A7S2 camera, a light carbon fiber tripod, the Osmo Plus, and a Magic Pro drone. His light gear means he's able to shoot and capture moments within a matter of seconds, not having to worry about standing out as a reporter or setting up a large tripod and missing the action. It means he's always ready and always on duty, looking for new stories, filming, editing, and publishing.
When I'm on these trips, I am just in pure adrenaline. And the adrenaline is starting to kind of wear off. I've noticed, I just got back yesterday from this last trip in Mexico and Morocco, and I was not nearly as fruitful as I was in the first couple of trips. And that's simply, that was proof to me that the only way I was able to bust out 4 dispatches in Japan and 3 dispatches in the Arctic was because of pure adrenaline. I was just like so stoked about the notion of doing it. I didn't have a lot more on my plate. I just would go out, do my reporting for the Borders documentaries, but then notice things. Oh, look at all these vending machines in Japan, or why are there so many Teslas here in Oslo? And pull out my little Osmo, this little fun camera that has it's a stabilized gimbal. And so it's very easy. It's just a point and shoot, essentially, that it's not a lot of difficulty to press record on it. And just walk around the city, like on my way to an interview, and talk to it and kind of pontificate on what I'm seeing. And, you know, researching kind of on the fly. I would literally be on like a subway reading academic articles on electric vehicles in Scandinavia, you know, and like the trends and looking at market research and just doing an on the fly research and then recording stuff. I mean, if someone saw the behind the scenes of these dispatches, it's the scrappiest operation in the world. Like, I don't plan I just am showing up, I'm seeing stuff, and then I'm immediately digesting information and looking at sources and even calling people just on the fly. And then once I have all the stuff recorded, then it's just my nights, you know, like I'm back in the hotel and I'm just editing nonstop. I'm sorting the footage from the day, but then I'm also just editing nonstop. And then, of course, I have an editor who helps me, you know, pare down and this and that. But yeah, it's a little bit of a crazy thing. I don't recommend the take on dispatches while you're making big documentaries model to people who want to like stay sane, but it definitely has been fun and exciting and intense. But like I said, I'm getting to the point where it's almost wearing off, because now I'm starting to think, man, I have to make these documentaries. And truly, the dispatches, the travel log, the social media is truly a separate enterprise in my mind. It is a separate experience that I'm doing solely to keep publishing. You know, I don't want to disappear for 6 months. I wanted to keep publishing and keep making stuff. I think I'd go crazy if I didn't. And then also to just raise awareness of this journey and to create engagement and investment from viewers to say, wow, this thing's happening, and we're preparing. You know, this guy's in Japan now, and he's in the Arctic, and I keep kind of planting the seed that in the fall, you know, that's when you're going to see the real documentaries. So all overall, it was kind of an on-the-fly experiment to play around with these dispatches. They aren't by any means the fundamental output of the Borders Enterprise. They are just a separate side gig that have been fun. And the upshot is they're extremely exhausting to keep up with. And that's why you'll see a downtick, honestly, in the output. I'm working on one for Mexico right now, but I'm just slogging through it. Whereas in Japan, I whipped one out in 2 days because I was so stoked on them. So there's a little bit of that fluctuation. I have a research fellow who I hired to help me with planning and research and logistics. And she's been fantastic. Her name is Christina, and she wasn't on until after the Arctic, but for these last few stories, she has been 100% integral to make it happen. And then one of the interns from our engagement team has been like taking on the Borders output. And so he's been helping me just keep the Facebook feed alive. And so I just taught him how to edit. And I was like, dude, I can't do these dispatches anymore. I'm getting tired. Can you like at least cut them down? You know, I'm like, I feel like I'm just so worn down with it. So he's been helping too. So yeah, I definitely have support now. Having a team is really helpful, but once you have a team, then suddenly you have to start to coordinate and you have to start to transfer the vision and edit and rounds and notes, and suddenly it turns into more of a managerial experience than just, again, when in Japan with the vending machines, I'm excited about these vending machines or these business cards or whatever it is, and I just go back to the hotel and I just edit and I just write and I report, and all of that happening in one brain is a much more efficient process, in my opinion. Although, of course, that's not, I don't want to disparage my team. I love my team. It just requires a little bit more of a managerial experience once you are working with a bunch of other people to create something.
Borders, the 6-part documentary series, which Johnny's been filming alongside his dispatches, will be a bit more somber and intense than his social media offerings. As a whole, they will interrogate the concept of borders in the hope that audiences will walk away having a better understanding of how borders have affected the globe. So what has Johnny learned while investigating this topic?
Policy matters. I mean, I know that's like we all know that, you know, policy affects people's lives, but to see these border policies and how they play out in people's lives, and how if the policy was just tweaked a little bit to let this person do this, their lives would be completely different. That to me has been such a huge outcome of this, for me, my understanding of the way that broad, huge policies that no one even thinks about can shape people's lives. It reminds me of the analogy I can think of is of urban design. Urban design is this this endeavor that designers think up in an office, and then they implement it in real life. And it affects all of our lives, how we go up the stairs, how we move along a sidewalk, how we go up this elevator, what direction we turn when we get to the end of this road. All those things happen almost subconsciously without us really knowing that that was a manipulation of our physical environment. That's exactly how it works at borders, and how it works with migration, and how it works with policy in a border context. These borders and these policies are all thought up and worked out in rooms with leaders, and then they're implemented and they affect people's lives very severely. One of the things on a more specific level that I walk away learning is how countries outsource their border security. I see the United States using Mexico as a huge buffer to stop Central Americans from getting into the United States. And how that plays out, how the U.S. is basically outsourcing its security. Spain is doing the exact same thing with Morocco. It's saying, Morocco, we don't want to deal with all these people coming to our border, so you deal with it, and we'll give you favors. We'll give you economic and political favors if you will be our first line of defense against these sub-Saharan Africans that we don't want in our European Union. So that's been a really fascinating dynamic to see how that plays out, and how these patron states have taken on the task of doing the border security for someone else. And then the last one is that even though we try to draw these lines and we do our best to draw the line and we have a map, and on this side the country is purple, and then you draw the line and then there's this new country that's green and it looks so neat, when you get there you realize that borders are these very psychological creations that actually don't work 100% of the time. Meaning you go to a border region and it feels like a melange of two different cultures that truly come together. I was just in Gibraltar last week, and it was a perfect example of the British enclave that you hear them speaking, and they speak this Yanita language I don't remember the name of it, but it's this language that is literally a melange of Spain Spanish and British English. And it is exactly, and I speak both of those languages. And so being able to listen to this totally crazy, exactly what you would expect when you think of two cultures mashing up against each other, that language to me is a great manifestation of how borders work. You can draw a line, but that line will inevitably have culture seeping through it, and language and food and all of these things. I saw this on every border area that I was. This is perfect bleeding of culture between, and I find that really, really fascinating. No matter how intense the border security is, culture will still find a way to seep back and forth.
Johnny explains to me that the process to produce the Borders documentary series has been an eye-opening experience. He's interviewed people from all walks of life while out on the road, aiming to capture human stories that demonstrate the impact of these man-made lines, something that many of us have not taken time to think about. As a mobile reporter out on the road, he's had to juggle communicating with his audience on social media, with producing regular updates on his travel blog, and of course gathering material for the Borders documentary. I asked Johnny what he would have done differently if he had the opportunity to do this again.
I would have looked at every one of my assertions, all the things that I was trying to say in these videos, and made sure that I had not only a visual evidence for each of them, which it was what I did. I kind of wrote down all my visual evidence for each one of my assertions, but also that I had a human character for each one, for each assertion, a human character that could help me humanize that issue. And I did in a lot of cases just by the fact that I was there and talking to people, but that I would have, as someone who could have made these videos from an office and just animated an archive, the point of going to a place is not just to say you went to the place to report it, but it's to talk to people and it's to have interactions. You can always hire a video journalist to go film the melting ice or to film the border between Guatemala and Mexico. You can't hire someone to go have a conversation and to get clear human thoughts on what's happening. And so I guess what I would have done differently is I would have made sure that each one of my big, broad points, my theses, were backed up by a character that was experiencing that. And like I said, I luckily was able to do that. But there were cases where I said, man, I should have really found someone to personify or to humanize this specific issue, and I didn't. I didn't have that in every single case, and I regret that. I don't think it's going to matter too much in the end of the day, but these stories are supposed to be about people, and it's about to be about how people interact. And making sure that that is the focus of any reporting trip, to me, is something that is easy to forget, and it's hard to do. It's difficult to find characters who want to talk and who personify issues, but it's vital. It's vital to making your trip worth it and making it actually the purpose of traveling far away and using resources to do that. Those conversations are the most valuable part of those trips. My strength is actually context and broader kind of political trends and policy. That's what we do here, is we talk about the big broad things. We talk to the experts. That to me is the easier part, to go out, talk to, read the big think tank reports, talk to the big experts, get their big analysis and their takeaway, and flesh out that context, that history, that policy. To me, the harder part, and so I had no problem doing that. That was like second nature. I've been doing that for years, you know, as a Vox person. The harder part to me is to do that original making sense of the chaos of the human experience. That to me is the hardest part, because people don't live in neat boxes and neat categories that help you further your thesis. They don't behave in ways that are so clear cut and surprising and interesting. they're messy and they have a million different thoughts and their thoughts contradict each other and they interact with policies in contradictory, strange ways. And so if I'm going to make a 15-minute documentary about how people live around a border, I really have to dive in and tease out what is the broad takeaway from this human experience. And it's not easy. You have to have a lot of conversations. You have to poke and you have to pry into why people do this and what they're actually thinking. And then you have to synthesize all of that into, you know, an interesting, surprising takeaway. Definitely the macro stuff is interesting and it's helpful and it's vital to my work. But that's the easy part, in my opinion.
And you can follow Johnny on Facebook, Instagram, and the Vox YouTube channel as he takes the last leg of his trip to China. For more podcasts from journalism.co.uk, please visit our website.